From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about acting and hard times with Danny Aiello. He stars in Ruby, a new film about the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. Also, high stakes, high stress, and phone calls in the middle of the night. We talk with money trader Andrew Krieger about making millions, losing millions, and remaining obsessed with a form of trading even his wife doesn't understand. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about the first jazz record ever released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democrat Paul Tsongas has officially suspended his bid for the presidency. The former Massachusetts senator made the announcement at a news conference in Boston. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
Tsongas says a lack of cash is the reason for his sudden decision today. After a poor showing in recent contests in the South and the Midwest, Tsongas' campaign has run up a debt close to $1 million. Tsongas says he does not have the resources to compete effectively in upcoming primaries.
The alternative was to play the role of spoiler. That is not what I'm about. That is not worthy. I did not survive my ordeals in order to be the agent of the re-election of George Bush.
While he will no longer campaign actively, Tsongas' delegates will represent him at the convention, and his name will appear on the remaining primary ballots. Tsongas says he will support the eventual Democratic nominee, but for now he is not endorsing Bill Clinton or Jerry Brown. Today he declined to say whether he would consider serving as either candidate's vice president. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
Argentine President Carlos Menem led thousands of people through Buenos Aires today in a march of solidarity with Israel. The march came as rescuers continued to search the wreckage of the bombed Israeli embassy for bodies. The death toll in the bombing rose to at least 24 today, including two diplomats and two wives of diplomats. Most of the other victims were Argentines. The Islamic Jihad, a pro-Iranian terrorist group in Lebanon, has claimed responsibility for the bombings, saying it was an act of revenge for Israel's killing of a Hezbollah leader. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said today that talks with Iraqi officials over limited oil exports will resume a week from today in Vienna. Boutros-Ghali also said Iraq has been given no new deadline to comply with UN ceasefire resolutions. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In his first news conference since taking office, Boutros-Ghali denied reports that Iraq has been given a March 26th deadline to destroy its weapons of mass destruction. He said there is no deadline and no time frame. However, Iraq is clearly under intense pressure to cooperate with the UN right now. A new UN inspection team is to visit the country this weekend to begin dismantling Iraq's ballistic missile production equipment. Some diplomats say any effort by Iraq to obstruct the team's work could provoke a U.S. military strike. Meanwhile, talks will resume next week in Vienna over oil sales. UN officials have drawn up a plan to allow Iraq limited oil exports if part of the revenues go to pay ceasefire costs. But Iraq has so far rejected the plan. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 3,261.4. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Israeli army has issued an order banning Palestinians from the occupied Gaza Strip from entering Israel. The order is to take effect tomorrow and remain in place indefinitely. It comes after two Israelis were killed and 20 wounded in a stabbing attack by a Palestinian man from Gaza on Tuesday. An army source said the travel ban on Gaza was imposed to reduce friction between the residents of Gaza and Israel after the stabbings. The order will directly affect about 20,000 Gazans who travel to Israel each day to work, mostly as laborers. About 750,000 people live in the Gaza Strip. Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has ended his week-long visit to Washington, where he met with State Department officials and congressional leaders. Aristide is no closer to returning to power. Last night, the Haitian parliament failed to ratify an agreement to restore democracy. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
A Bush administration official said today that there is less than a 50% chance that the Haitian parliament will ratify an agreement calling for the return of President Aristide. The official statement came the day after Haitian lawmakers failed to vote on the accord, which was mediated last month by the Organization of American States. Last night, Haitian legislators opposed to Aristide staged a walkout that deprived the parliament of enough members to hold a vote. The session then collapsed, with fistfights breaking out among some lawmakers. Another session to vote on ratification has not been set. Meanwhile, Aristide finished his visit this week in Washington. He declined to comment directly on last night's developments, but said he was hopeful the OAS brokered agreement would eventually be ratified. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The gap between what the United States imports and what it sells abroad narrowed slightly in January, but exports fell, leading experts to predict that the improvement in the balance of trade may not last. The merchandise trade deficit dropped by 3.9% from the month before. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, Ruby, is about Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. But the film doesn't obsessively work out a complex conspiracy theory like the movie JFK. The Kennedy assassination is almost peripheral to Ruby. This new film is more of a character study of a man who is everybody's patsy, the mob, the cops, the CIA. My guest, Danny Aiello, stars as Jack Ruby. Aiello is a great actor with no formal training, but he has plenty of what's called life experience. He used to work for Greyhound Bus and was the president of the union local. After a dispute with management, he was out of a job, and when he needed money real bad, he stole it. Then he worked as a bouncer at several clubs. He didn't start acting until his mid-30s. He got his breaks in the films Purple Rose of Cairo as Mia Farrow's husband, in Moonstruck as Cher's intended, and in Do the Right Thing as Sal, the owner of the pizzeria. Danny Aiello told me he remembers watching Ruby shoot Oswald live on TV.
I went, yip, yip, hooray. I believed at that time, Terry, in street justice, an eye for an eye. He killed our president, and this guy killed him. Good. That's how I felt. And this, of course, was the germ of the idea where I began to formulate the character of Ruby. I made him in my own mind a hero. And as we know, the way Ruby ends up, we find out that he's really not a hero, and he's realizing it toward the end of his life. But that was my reaction.
When did you stop thinking hip, hip, hooray?
Well, hip, because, you know, I still have a feeling about Ruby. I feel that he murdered this guy, but I truly feel that he was a victim as well of the kind of a person he was. He was a very ingratiating person. He was a chameleon kind of person. He was a person who brushed shoulders with many, many kinds of people. And whenever he did that, assuming that it was a wise guy, he would attempt to take on the persona of a wise guy. If he was on a stage introducing an act, he suddenly became Dale Carnegie with a southern twinge in his voice, therefore placating his audience. And if he was with an intellectual, he would become or attempt to become that kind of a person. He was a person that was looking for acceptance all of his life, I feel. And through my investigation of the character and a little that there was on Ruby, I formulated this kind of character, which I thought would be complex and very nice to do. He never left me. He has never left me. The word hero might not be the correct one, but he's never left me as a guy who did what he had to do. The reason, if I do call him a hero and feel that he was a hero, I don't know exactly when I stopped feeling that way. I don't know if I entirely have stopped feeling that way. But he was a guy who did something he felt, in my opinion, was patriotic. He did something which he felt was going to uplift his race of people, which are Jewish people. This is what I feel. He did something that he thought was heroic, only later to find out that people didn't think he was a hero. He thought they stole from the American people. He stole from the American people the opportunity of finding out what actually did happen. And as a result of that, they felt that he was a conspirator. And I think from that point on was when his downfall was, and he slowly died from then on.
You portray Ruby as a small-time guy who's gotten in over his head.
Absolutely.
And who often has to bluff his way out of tight situations. And you do wonderful line readings in the movie. I mean, I think you just convey a lot with your voice and with where you put the accents in certain readings of lines. I wonder how you rehearse these things, even at home. And I don't even necessarily mean on the set, but when you got this script and you were trying to figure out how you would do the character, how you would do specific lines, what's your process like for testing out your line reading?
I wish I had a process. I do it until I learn it, and I don't learn it. I'm talking about line by line by line. I don't memorize it to the extent where it's like rote. It's always got to be fresh and new to me. I like to go before the cameras knowing the lines, but I'm not totally sure of them. Do you follow what I mean? So that when they do come out of my mouth, they appear to be coming out of my mouth for the first time. I don't know what the system is. People at the American Academy asked me to come over and teach. I said, what am I going to teach? They said, the ILO system. I said, what is that? I have no way of defining it. All I know is I sit by myself, with myself, I work on the script, and it's a matter of repetition, constantly going over the entire script, interrelating with other characters, what other characters mean to me. And then I find, after making all the plans that I can, when I'm finally going before the cameras opposite the other actor, things change. And they all start all over again, and it's probably nothing that I've been rehearsing. But I like to go in there with that feeling that I'm not quite sure what all the lines are, so that it comes out not like rote, as I said before.
Yeah, no, I understand. When you were shooting Ruby, how aware were you of JFK, of Oliver Stone's movie? And I wonder if Ruby was almost rushed out so it would get to screens in time to ride the crest of the assassination wave.
This is a very important question you're giving me, Terry, and I should have said this up front to you before I did, before we got into it. But Ruby was an idea long before JFK was thought of being made a motion picture. Ruby was a stage play written by Stephen Davis, who was the screenwriter of Love Field, which was the other title for Ruby, and we couldn't use Love Field because it was another motion picture. We had to use Ruby. It was on a stage in London before JFK was thought of being made. It was picked up by Propaganda Films. JFK, of course, was later being made. This script then came to my attention. We all decided to do it. We put it together. It happened to coincide with the last 2 weeks of their shooting was when we were beginning. We had no time rush to get it open. And I'll tell you why. I wanted to rush. I wanted to get it open at the same time JFK was open so that people had an alternative. Or they could see both and, you know, get what they will out of both. They couldn't rush it because they felt they had a good motion picture and they certainly didn't want it to appear as if we were trying to rip off JFK or the success of JFK.
Yeah, well, I should say that the assassination is really such a small part of the movie in a way.
It is, really. I think it's about relationships. And the thing that I love JFK, let me say, as a motion picture. You should know that. And I make my comparisons. I just feel that our film, it's a terrible thing to say, especially when you're in it and you're doing the lead in it, you're playing the title character. But I think our film's a more accessible film. I think the people are more real. I think they're smaller in stature, in size, and therefore gives you the opportunity to really get into the story of Ruby. In JFK, everyone appears to be bigger in life, even the way that they decided to cast it. They have 40 stars, named stars, playing minor roles, which is great, but we have wonderful actors, probably equally as wonderful, not as well known. We have faces in our film like it was a Fellini film. I mean, faces you haven't been seeing in 900 pictures. And many of those guys happen to be my friends.
Oh, really? Literally? They were cast because they were your friends?
Well, not because of that. Because ultimately, the decision was being made by Joanna Ray, who's the casting person from England. Wonderful.
But you
and
got
John
them seen.
McKenzie. But I wanted John to see these people. I said, John, instead of people that have been exposed so much in all the Scorsese films, the Coppola films, not that they're not great, but let's look brand new here. And I was happy that many of the decisions or suggestions were mine. I mean, they were just wonderful. I'm so proud of the job that they did. And let me tell you, they didn't work for the money they usually make. They make a lot more because we didn't have a $50 million movie. We had somewhere in the air of a $9 million movie.
Did you work for less than usual?
Well, they paid me a lot of money.
Right, okay.
No, I didn't work. On Do the Right Thing, I worked for less.
Right.
And because that was a very low-budgeted film.
Right.
This was a mediocre-budgeted film, somewhere in a $9 or $10 million right. area. And no, I worked for my money then, and they gave it to me. And I'm very happy about that, but I also feel that I worked very hard to depict a character which I hope the American public would find as somewhat sympathetic.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny Aiello, and he stars in the new movie, Ruby. You started acting when you were in your mid-30s. Did you have any idea before that you were even interested in acting?
No, I gravitated toward acting, Terry, because I thought it might be, it's a communication media, and I was a fairly good talker, and I was fairly good with people, that maybe this would be the way to go. I was uneducated. I was in high school for about a half hour. I went in one door and out the other. I went to James Monroe. So I really had no education, no trade. So I felt that the obvious place to go after losing the union job would be into acting, never realizing how difficult that profession is. But I did it anyway. But I never thought I would be a failure. I always thought to some level I would be a success if I dedicated myself. And look what happened, you know.
I'm interested in your early life. Your father was a teamster and was on the road a lot.
Yeah, my father was not home. We had what could be perceived as a fatherless home.
Right.
Amanda would come home once a year, impregnate my mother, have a steak while we all ate macaronis and beans. But Mama managed to find a steak for him somehow, and he ate it. He ate it very proudly at the table while we ate macaroni and beans. But it was my mother who was solely responsible for the bringing up of 7 children.
I know you went to work when you were very young, but I think you also got involved in robberies when you were pretty young,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did some crazy things. I had a fear, Terry, of being homeless, and that was early on. I don't know when that was put in my mind. I guess maybe if Mama decided to run off like Dad did, then the 7 kids would have been homeless. So I guess that was the germ of the idea in my mind. And as I grew up and I lost my union presidency job, and there was very little for me to, you know, I was making $190 here, then I was making nothing. I got frightened, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to keep a roof over the heads of my 4 children and my wife and myself. And I did things to compensate for that, and they were not armed robberies. They were not hitting people over the head. They were some maybe deserted buildings where there might be a safe. I did some silly, stupid things that I feel ashamed I did, and I hate to even talk about them in public because it sends out mixed signals. It's like the dope addict who says, look, you kids can don't start dope, you know, but he's telling a kid not to start dope when he was a dope addict and is now telling people he got off of it and he's a famous person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
So I don't like to send out those messages, but the fact is that was my life. And I try to justify it by saying, you know, I was desperate, I thought we were going to be homeless, and that was the only way I can turn, because at that point in my life, it was pretty hard for me to have no money coming in and supporting a family of 6. 4 children, my wife and I.
Did you make sure the statute of limitations was up before mentioning
it
publicly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. What a wise son of a gun I am, but I did. And, you know, I don't want you to think that it was like this was an ongoing thing forever. It was a thing that happened until the fear became so great in me that I said, I just can't do this, because what I would be doing is losing my family anyway if I did have to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And things, just as God wants, started to work out. See, I had the problem, I never wanted to borrow money from anyone. I wouldn't take money, I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't accept help from anyone. And the only help that I did accept was something that really set me off to stealing, and that was welfare. I didn't have the guts to go into the welfare office. My wife did. Twice on welfare for 2 months. My wife stood in line humiliated, right? And she came from a family that had money. She was humiliated and she stood there. And I swore I would never do that again. So when we started to get destitute again, I refused to go back there. So the next thing that I did was decide to make money in another way. Sandy had no idea I did it. She thought I was hustling pool again because I was an expert pool shooter, billiard shooter at the early time of my life. So I was telling Sandy lies as to where I was getting the rent money. There were times that I was 4 or 5 months behind in my rent, and I was afraid we were going to be homeless again, so I would go out and do something, and I'd break into cigarette machines, jukeboxes. I used to pay rent with quarters and nickels and dimes. It's crazy, and I'm ashamed to tell you this, Terry, and I don't want you to think any less of me for it, but I'll tell you, people do that, and we can be critical and should be critical because no one should have to do that. But sometimes you get so desperate and you have no one to turn to ask the advice, and you go out and do it.
So what was the job that got you out of this?
Well, the acting started to come more and more, and I started bouncing in Roseland, and I took other bouncing jobs to supplement my earnings. Then, of course, the improvisation again. Then I began getting Broadway shows, acting jobs. Remember, the first acting jobs I got were on a stage, and they were off Broadway. They were so off, it was like in a Bronx somewhere. And they were paying very, very little money, if not any money at all, you know. They were like Equity Productions, 13 performances. The fortunate thing is a writer by the name of Louis LaRusso had written me 3 off Broadway plays. And I gave back his audition, and each one of those plays, I took to Broadway and starred in each of them.
My guest is actor Danny Aiello. He's starring in the new film Ruby. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Danny Aiello is my guest. You know, we were talking about bluffing. The way you play Jack Ruby, he has to bluff his way through a lot of situations. I'm wondering, when you started to act, did you have to bluff your way into acting? Did you have to make it seem like you really knew what you were doing, even though you had no experience?
Terry, I never studied one day in my life as an actor. I never went to school. I was a man in a hurry. I started at 35. I felt schooling at this point to learn how to act is not what I need. If I don't know how to get up there and recreate things that I've had or experienced on the street, then I have a serious problem. So I was a man in a hurry. The bluffing came where you had to lie, unfortunately, like most actors beginning do. They put on their resume, some phony resume, and because when you go in without a resume, you sit there with an agent. He said, what have you done? And you say, well, I haven't done anything yet. He said, well, I said, well, you get in what they call a catch-22. You can't get an agent unless you've done something. You can't get a job unless you have an agent. So what do you do? You know, somewhere along the line, someone has to believe that you can do it. Someone's got to be willing to give you that job.
What would you do at auditions to try to impress casting directors?
Well, auditions for me were horrific. I don't know that I've ever got a job in my life auditioning. I usually got my jobs talking head-to-head with the director. He got to know about me. I got to know about him. But auditioning, even at this time, 7 years ago, I decided I will never audition again. I will never put the power in anyone's hands and tell them they haven't got it. I have got it. I am a firm believer, if I was a director, there is not an actor in the world that I couldn't cast for a movie if I was directing it by simply sitting opposite him and talking to him and having a conversation and being able to decide at that moment that I can work with this man and I can get what I want on the screen from this man. Reading of roles and trying to be someone and a cold reading or even a prepared reading is never what a good actor ends up doing anyway.
Because it's so contrived.
All baloney.
Yeah.
All you're doing is teaching the director and those other people who was his hangarounds want to learn about the character.
You know, one of your really big breakthrough roles was a Sal in Do the Right Thing, and I really loved you in that film. And I always felt watching that movie that Spike Lee probably saw the character as a blatant racist, but that you gave the character a depth and integrity. And I know you actually even wrote lines for the character to flesh the character out. But it was as if, to me, it was as if Spike Lee didn't notice that the character had changed by virtue of your interpretation of it. And so in the meantime, all the plot was proceeding as if you were this one-dimensional racist, when in fact the character you were playing was no longer that.
Yeah, if you pick up his original script, the original, you'll see that he was a one-note character. To me, he was what I would have called in the old days a token black in an all-white film. In this case, he could have been a token white in an all-black film. When I looked at it, I told Spike, I said, this guy's a plantation owner. This guy's a boring character. Why is he there? Why is he in Bed-Stuy? Why has he got a pizzeria and in a totally black neighborhood? I said, he can be anywhere. So I defined in my own mind that he's there because that's where he wants to be. He likes the people. He enjoys the people he's working with. He saw them get older. He enjoys the fact that they love his food. He's that kind of a simple guy, and it was because of that, I think, that made the character a more sympathetic character and they're a multi-dimension character as opposed to a simple out-and-out racist. Now, you may define in your own mind or come to the conclusion that Sal is a racist, but it's not obvious.
But do you think that Spike Lee maybe didn't even notice how the character was changing? In other words, I always felt that the movie proceeded, the plot proceeded as if some of the people were acting to you like you were this just one-note racist, which the character no longer was.
Well, that may be the ability to people to either respond as actors or not be able to respond to what it is they're hearing. You know what I mean? With Spike, I have to give him this. Before I agreed to do this, I said I wanted to make some changes. He said, anything you want to do to make it better. That's what Spike said. And he went with the program as we were going. See, there was one part of the film at the end where it bothered me that Spike's character, Mookie, said to Sal, my character, what are you arguing about after the place was burned down? You're going to get your money back on insurance. I was infuriated by that remark because you cannot, as a store owner, as a business owner in Bed-Stuy, get insurance. So I said, this is a joke. Why are you saying that? I said, I want to come back. Well, what are you kidding? You? I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. He didn't want that line in. So I had to write this other line. This isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Do you remember that line? So he compromised somewhat. He didn't want me to say I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. But he did permit me to say, this isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Anything anyone ever tells me could never make me believe that Sal was an out-and-out racist. What Sal is a realist. If a man, forgive my language, or anyone who may be offended, looks at Sal and calls him a guinea, Sal will in kind come back and call you a nigger, a spick, a mick, a kite. Do you follow what I'm saying? He would go to the core of trying to hurt that person as that person just tried to hurt him. That's the honesty of Sal.
You're just joining us. My guest is Danny Aiello, and he stars in the new movie Ruby about Jack Ruby. I know one of the early jobs you had was working for Greyhound. You were the president of the union local there. You were an announcer for the buses.
Yes.
When was the last time you were at a Greyhound terminal?
I always stop by there, and I stop by there every so often just to recall the past. Because there's so many things that are no longer vivid to me. Every house I ever lived in New York City, and I lived in about maybe 35 apartments, have all been torn down. There's not a place where I lived as a kid that I can identify as a place where I lived. So any place that has some history that I had something to do with, such as Greyhound, I like to go back to. I haven't spoken to anyone. I don't know too many of the people there, because that was in 1967 that I lost that job. I would just go back to look and remember that this is where I was.
Danny Aiello stars in the new film Ruby. He spoke to us from his hotel room in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's it like spending each day taking multi-million dollar risks? Coming up, we ask money trader Andrew Krieger, a man who seems considerably less stressed out than I am. And then again, I'm not making millions of dollars. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about a new reissue that marks the 75th anniversary of recorded jazz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Paul Tsongas has suspended his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, citing a lack of enough money to continue campaigning effectively in the primary still to come. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton spoke with reporters at the Little Rock Airport about Tsongas leaving the race. Ben Fry of member station KUAR in Little Rock reports.
Governor Clinton says that he was surprised when Paul Tsongas called him this morning to say he was dropping out of the race. The governor praised Tsongas for getting into the race when President Bush still had a 90% approval rating, and he credited the former Massachusetts senator with keeping the campaign focused on economic issues.
He's made an extraordinary contribution to this campaign, and I want us to make it crystal clear to the American people that the Democrats are pro-growth, very serious about restoring long-term growth to this economy, and he has a major contribution to make in that regard.
Clinton says he's not taking the election for granted and will continue to campaign as planned. He'll campaign this evening in Connecticut and return to Arkansas tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
And Democratic presidential contender Jerry Brown is also campaigning in the state of Connecticut, and today said the fact that Tsongas is out of the race does not change his plans, and he promised a head-to-head battle with Clinton for what he termed the soul of the Democratic Party. On Capitol Hill, the man who ran the House post office has resigned. He's the second House official in a week to step down after allegations against House facilities of mismanagement. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Robert Rota was the postmaster of the House post office for almost 20 years. Today, the chairman of the House Administration Committee, which oversees the post office, referred to him as Can't Say No Rota. According to unsubstantiated allegations published today in the Washington Times, while Rota was in charge, members illegally cashed their paychecks at the post office. Three former clerks at the post office recently pleaded guilty to embezzlement. Another admitted dealing drugs. The operations of the post office have been under investigation for many months, both by the U.S. Postal Inspector and by a bipartisan task force of lawmakers. Rota's resignation follows the resignation last week of Sergeant-at-Arms Jack Russ. Russ was another top patronage employee responsible for operations at the scandal-ridden House Bank. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A federal judge in Washington has struck down a portion of an ethics law that barred federal workers from accepting payment for outside speeches and articles. The court agreed with arguments by the federal workers that a section of law aimed at them violated their First Amendment right to free speech. The judge ruled that Congress was mainly concerned about stopping its own members from accepting money in a way that created an appearance of undue influence. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 7 points to close at 3,261.40 in active trading. This is NPR News. The government says that the nation's trade deficit dropped by 3.9% in January to $5.8 billion. Imports were off by 1.4% compared to December, while exports dropped 1%. The January trade deficit with Japan fell to $3.8 billion from $4.5 billion in December. The U.S., France, and Britain are asking the U.N. Security Council to impose an air embargo against Libya, and the Bush administration is warning Americans to leave that country now. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Libya has ignored earlier U.N. demands to turn over those accused of bombing Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and Flight 772 of UTA, a French-owned airline, over West Africa. 441 people from more than 30 countries died in those two bombings. Because Libya has failed to cooperate, the U.S., France, and Britain are seeking a new Security Council resolution containing several measures against Libya. Most of those measures have not been announced. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler explained why the air embargo was announced.
Once airline links are broken, it will be obviously more difficult to leave the country. The United States government strongly advises American citizens who may be present in Libya to depart immediately.
Tutwiler estimated that there are from 500 to 1,000 Americans in Libya now. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Officials in Blacksville, West Virginia, say an above-ground explosion at a coal processing plant has killed two people and injured at least three others. The explosion occurred as workers were getting ready to seal a mine shaft and could be felt up to 15 miles away. The blast destroyed a seven-story building containing two empty coal bins. Company officials say the cause of this explosion is not known. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When I interviewed Andrew Krieger yesterday, he had other things on his mind. He was watching his mini-computer screen that was displaying up-to-the-second fluctuations in the currency market. I didn't take it personally. Krieger is always plugged into the market. His house is wired. His phone often rings in the middle of the night with calls about what's happening in the Asian markets. What he does is invest in currencies, dollars, yen, marks, speculating on which currencies will rise in value and which will fall. His new book is called The Money Bazaar, Inside the Trillion-Dollar World of Currency Trading. He runs his own company now, but when he worked for Bankers Trust in the 80s, he was considered one of the most successful young traders in the business. He's made, lost, and made millions of dollars in a market most people don't understand.
What I try to do is figure out what sort of structural changes can occur in the world's markets, which are going to cause a shift in what we call investor preferences to hold one currency versus another. Markets are always seeking some sort of state of equilibrium. So if you take that as your basic assumption, my job is to figure out where equilibrium theoretically would be at any one time and where that state of equilibrium is going to slide to.
When you're trading in international currency, is it a buy low, sell high type of thing? Is it the same, similar to the stock market?
Sure. In fact, one of the things I discuss in the book is that my concept of a currency is that it's very much akin to the stock of a country. So yes, I want to buy low and sell high, or sell high and buy low.
How is the currency similar to the stock in a country?
What goes into people's estimation of where a currency belongs relative to another is they have to look at the political structure, they have to look at the educational system, they have to look at the philosophies towards investments and savings and the practices towards investments and savings. They look at the military, they look at the natural resources, they look at the productivity, and all these different things sound very similar in a sense to measuring a value of a company. What kind of numbers is it producing? Are they producing big deficits or big surpluses? Are they generally profligate, or are they very tidy savers of their money and then smart investors? And all of these things are very similar to valuing a company.
But tell me exactly, what are you investing in when you put money into the currency market?
Okay. The funny thing about currencies, unlike stocks, stocks have an underlying entity, a company of some sort, right? And the company has some value, it has some assets, and it might have some, you know, some product that it's making or buying or selling. Currencies have no inherent value of their own. They only have a value on a relative basis. And so in a sense, it's a funny game because there's no inherent value for the dollar, say, or for the yen. It's always a relative value. So my job is to try to help people manage their currency exposures more efficiently. That is to say, if someone has to import goods from Japan, so they naturally therefore have a yen liability because they have to pay for these goods, and you know, with yen. Well, if the yen should strengthen dramatically, and they haven't covered their currency risk, then the fact is their company could go out of business from the currency fluctuations.
Wall Street of the 80s is now considered a symbol of greed and financial and materialistic excess. Did you feel like you were a part of that? I mean, you made a fortune trading currencies in the 1980s. You made $3 million in 1 year alone.
Well, Yeah, I think if you consider my background prior to my Wall Street experience, then maybe to understand my own feeling was that I was sort of sliding through somewhat objectively watching this process that I was perhaps in but not necessarily a part of in terms of my identification. You know, I spent many years studying more esoteric things, you know, philosophy and, you know, Sanskrit and that sort of thing. And the currency game was an entirely new game for me. It was one which I fell into almost by accident. So when I got to Wall Street, I didn't really have any set of parameters or reference points, but I had this little screen that told me the currency rates were going up and down. So for me, it was just an intellectual game or process to figure out if I could somehow construct strategies which would be profitable.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Andrew Krieger, and he's a currency trader and consultant, and he has his own firm and is the author of the new book, The Money Bazaar, which is about the currency market. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Krieger is my guest, author of the new book, The Money Bazaar. If you could describe in layperson's terms one of the best investments that you've ever made, one that, you know, made a fortune for you.
The one that I got the greatest satisfaction from was the, it started with a somewhat amusing notion that I had this idea in the early 1987 that the stock market was tremendously overvalued. By then, I was building up this notion that the U.S. had been very profligate and was building this pyramid of waste and sin and debt. And I said, well, if you're doing all the wrong things, the stock market really has to start coming down. And what I started doing was buying very, very inexpensive currency call options, priced to sort of in the November, December expiration time, which means that what I was betting on was that the dollar would start to decline very, very sharply between, say, the middle of August and the end of November or early December. And I bought these currency calls, and the market at that time had really been quite stable. So the options had a very, very low insurance premium or cost to them. And I just put it away, and the crash came, and the dollar started collapsing. And I remember sitting there, I had this feeling like somehow someone had handed me this key to this special little kingdom, and I was the only one allowed inside. And I had this feeling of like, a grace somehow that I'd been given this gift, and I got to pick whatever I wanted, and it was a feeling that I didn't really feel that I had done anything so smart or intelligent. I felt, frankly, that yeah, there had just been this gift that someone bestowed upon me, that I had this idea, and it worked out absolutely perfectly, and ended up making a couple $100 million on that play. And I said, well, gee, this is nice. I think I like this business.
But let me ask you, the collapse of the stock market and the collapse of the American dollar ended up being a gift for you, but how did you feel profiting so much at our country's disaster?
Well, the funny thing, and this is where the extent to which I'll say I was literally oblivious to some extent, maybe naive or maybe insensitive, but I felt, first of all, the stock market was built on, its rise had been built on all the wrong things. As I said, it built on greed and built on you know, terrible management of the government and all that sorts of stuff. So I said, well, hey, I think it's good to get a shakeout and get a clean out. And I really felt somehow that since I had no part in causing it, I was simply fulfilling my function, in a sense, doing my little duty as a trader. And I felt somewhat oblivious, really, or indifferent. Maybe that was insensitive, but that was what it was.
On the whole, you've made a lot of money, millions, right?
Yeah, on the whole, it's been quite profitable.
What do you do with your money?
Personal money?
Yeah. I mean, do you just keep reinvesting it, or are you living as wealthy a lifestyle as you potentially could?
Personally, I feel that I have a responsibility to add, well, let me put it differently. I look at myself something of a trustee for funds, whether someone's given me their own money to manage or whether it's my own money that's come to me. I feel that I'm a trustee, and my job is to somehow allocate to places where it's necessary. So I'm quite active in different sorts of service and charitable groups.
Can I ask you which charities you favor?
Well, one in particular I'm very active with is a group called Results, mm-hmm. which you may or may not be familiar with.
Not
yet. They have two components. One is it's sort of a grassroots lobbying group against hunger. And they're very, very active and quite successful in pushing certain types of programs, helping to push certain types of programs through Congress. The other part is sort of, it's a result, it's an educational fund, which is really dedicated towards trying to educate people about hunger issues. It's not an organization where they say, you know, send us your money, we're going to make sure the people in Biafra, Ethiopia, whatever, get food. But it's actually a group that's dedicated towards really the education of people about hunger issues and trying to sensitize them to the hunger issues and basic you know, child survival issues and that sort of thing, until hopefully people will say, hey, this is really unacceptable. I'm going to do something.
This is going to sound like an incredibly stupid question to you, but I'm the kind of person who expects a receipt whenever I get anything or leave anything. You know, I mean, I can't believe that I can, like, leave my car at either, at say, the mechanics or something. They don't give me a receipt saying that they have my car there, you know? So anyways, you're putting like zillions of dollars down on the telephone to invest in some currency. Mm-hmm. And it's just this oral thing on the telephone. You have no evidence.
It's shocking that it works. There are many, many people I've done billions of dollars of business with, and I've never met them. I don't know what they look like. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're tall or short or fat or old or what. But it's one of the amazing things about the market. It's one of the things that intrigues me about the market, in that it's completely self-correcting. It's a market that, yeah, ultimately there's a transfer of funds, but it's built to a very, very scary degree on trust. And that's actually kind of a nice thing, sort of a redeeming quality, I think, in today's society. That someone can call up as a counterparty or representative of one institution to another and say, you know, make me a market on $200 million against the yen, and they can do a trade.
But did anybody ever hear you wrong or forget the message or anything like that?
Well, everyone has tapes on their machines.
Oh.
So there was only one instance that I can recall where I didn't have a tape on the machine when I first started trading at Salomon Brothers, and there was one counterparty I called up in Germany, and I asked him for a price on $20 million against the mark, and I sold the dollars. And just as I sold the dollars, he agreed to the price, he agreed to the amount. He said thank you, I said thank you, hung up. Bundesbank then came and intervened and sold dollars. The dollar dropped about 2.5% straight away, and I called him back and I said, well, you know, where's the dollar? He told me where. I said, well, I'd like to buy back the $20 million. He said, what do you mean buy back? I said, well, I want to buy back the dollars that I sold to you before. He goes, no, you didn't sell any dollars to me before. And we went to the tapes, which curiously had somehow been missing. They couldn't find them, and we didn't have a tape. And we ended up splitting the difference. It was the only time in 8 years it's ever happened to me that someone reneged on a deal.
Yeah. You know, I have a couple of friends who I really can't comprehend the work they do, you know. you know, when we get together for dinner and I say, so what's new at work? I really can't understand what they're telling me, you know, because it has to do with something very esoteric financially or whatever.
Right.
I wonder if you have friends who really can't comprehend what you do.
I have a wife that doesn't really comprehend very well sometimes. She was very happy when I finally decided to write the book. She said, well, now I see what you do. I mean, she just had this sense of, I mean, see, her perspective of my trading means getting phone calls at 3 in the morning and then 4 in the morning and then 5 in the morning. And then occasionally hearing a telephone get slammed down because, you know, someone missed an order that they were supposed to execute. So her perspective is, gee, this is what work is. And she kind of misses the intellectual challenge of it that I go through. So I think for her, she probably shares some of your own experiences with some of your friends.
When you're trading these things that are like, you know, millions of dollars, and you're always dealing with millions of dollars, do you shop for things on sale or anything? I mean, what's the meaning of like a $25 purchase to you?
at first when I was trading, I couldn't conceptualize like making the shift from trading. You know, I mean, there were times when I've done deals in excess of $1 billion. And so I had a little trouble conceptualizing going into the store and worrying about whether it cost $23 or $25.
Yeah.
I was oblivious. But I was also working so hard I didn't really shop, so it didn't make any difference. It wasn't really an issue for me because I just, you know, I had my suits and I had, my wife was helping out with getting the food. And I didn't do any buying. So but it's something that it causes a warped perspective on life. There's no question, and you have to really sit back and say, "Hey, look, this is not real. These $1 billion that I'm buying and selling, that's not reality. It's not the way most people think or live."
What kind of car do you drive?
I drive a Toyota.
You're kidding?
No, I they make a great car. It's one of the Land Cruisers. We have four kids. We need a big vehicle.
Yeah, the Land Cruisers cost, right? I mean, not like a Mercedes.
Not like a Mercedes, no. but they're bigger than a Mercedes, and they're a lot sturdier, I reckon.
Uh huh.
And they gave me a 7-year warranty. I like that, and it helped my yen position a little bit because I bought a Japanese car.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Andrew Krieger is the author of the new book, The Money Bazaar. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Paul Tsongas is suspending his campaign for the presidency. We'll have a report from Boston. NPR's Deborah Wong has a story from Cambodia about thousands of refugees there after many years now trying to return to their homes. There is supposed to be peace in Cambodia. Dow Corning decides to stop making silicone breast implants, but the company still claims the implants are safe. And we'll analyze the white vote for reform in South Africa with a political scientist in that country. He says the white minority just did not have any other practical choice.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Seventy-five years ago this month, the first jazz record was released, or so the story goes. That record was made by the original Dixieland Jazz Band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this review of the new ODJB reissue.
Say it's March 1917. You walk into the furniture store where you'd bought your gramophone, looking for some new records to play. They've got a new one by a band with an odd name, a band you've never heard of. It sells for 75 cents, which is a lot of money, but something tells you to buy it. So you take it home, wind up the machine, and set down the needle, and this is what you hear. That's the Livery Stable Blues by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, released 75 years ago this month. RCA has just issued a CD of their recordings from 1917 to 1921. The ODJB was a white group from New Orleans, which made its way to New York in 1917 and began recording almost immediately. Livery Stable Blues, along with its flip side, the Dixieland Jazz Band One Step, is generally regarded as the first jazz record ever released. There may not be an improvised note on it, but it has the raucous ensemble blend, vocalized horn sound, and syncopated rhythm that help define jazz. ¶¶ hearing the original Dixieland Jazz Band 75 years ago must have been a shocker, but their music didn't emerge from a vacuum. The familiar story that jazz was born in New Orleans and spread to the world from there is more creation myth than reliable history. Distinct regional styles of jazz cropped up in Texas, New York, Kansas City, and other places in the 1920s and teens. Still, the ODJB's records were very influential, especially among young white musicians. They did not sell well among blacks, who may have been more aware of how hokey the band could sound. The business of making jazz records didn't really get rolling till about 1923, but a few other jazz musicians and fellow travelers recorded around the same time the original Dixieland Jazz Band made its debut. U.B. Blake and James P. Johnson were cutting player piano rolls in 1917. Black bandleader James Reese Europe had recorded even before that. Some folks argue his orchestral ragtime is really the first jazz on record. Europe's Down Home Rag, recorded in 1913, is as riff-happy as anything Glenn Miller ever did. James Reese Europe, 1913. The original Dixieland Jazz Band's records are important, whether they're the first documented jazz or not, if only because they show there was money to be made recording this music. Jazz would have caught on anyway, sooner or later, but this band got the process started. So it's a little scandalous these records have been unavailable for the last 20 years, a graphic example of how careless major record companies are about the national treasures they own the rights to. If you want a literary analogy, it's as if publishers let the 18th century novels of Samuel Richardson or Henry Fielding go out of print for decades at a stretch. Most record companies never got in the habit of looking at jazz as art. So if you're interested in these landmark recordings, you should pick up this new CD pretty soon. It may not be around too long.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelancer based in New York and the discographer for the new North American edition of the Jazz Book. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Reinventing Government, we talk with David Osborne, co-author of a new book that a lot of elected officials and at least one presidential candidate have read. It's about getting rid of government bureaucracy. Also, we meet Tom Seaver, one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight, light snow tapering off to flurries this evening, then gradually clearing after midnight, the low about 25 degrees. Tomorrow